The American dream. It's the belief that if you work hard enough and are persistent enough, you can become whatever you want to be. The biography of Dr. Joycelyn Elders is the biography of the American dream. This is the story of a sharecropper's daughter, an African-American girl who was the eldest of eight children. As a child, she picked cotton, cared for her siblings, and hoped for the day that she might work as a shopkeeper. As an adult, she's a mother, a doctor, a scientist, and an outspoken advocate for children's health. She started with nothing and went on a journey that would wind through medical school here at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences and lead as far as the nation's capital in 1993 as the Surgeon General of the United States. Dr. Elders is a woman of distinction whose intellect and strong sense of conviction have always kept her a little ahead of her time. You were all lived together, you were eight children, two adults, and in one house. Tell me about your house. You didn't have running water or electricity or telephone or natural gas, probably.
No. What we lived in, what would be called technically, would be a three-room shack, if you will. You know, we had what was a kitchen, or a bigger bedroom with the fireplace where my mom and dad and sisters and brothers slept. And then my sisters and myself, there was another bedroom that where we were, but there was never any heat in our room. The only heat we had was the fireplace or the cook stove. And we had no air conditioning. We didn't even have a fan, except a piece of board that we would use to fan when it was extremely hot. So it was under the most dire conditions, very, very poor. But the one thing that I must say, I never remember us being hungry because we raised all of our food. My mom would work in the fields all day long and come home and can, putting up fruits and vegetables until the middle of the night, get up early the next morning, fixing lunch to take to the fields, and the fields were sometimes 4 or 5 miles away, and we would have to go to the fields in this wagon, pulled by horses or mules, and take our lunch, and we would work from sun up to sundown.
Joycelyn Elders was born in 1933 as Minnie Lee Jones in the small town of Shawl, Arkansas. The eldest of eight children, her life as a child was potluck picnics after church, walking to school with her best friend, picking cotton, and watching after her brothers and sisters. Her father was a man of few words who worked as a sharecropper and hunted fox and raccoons, whose skins he sold to buy his first 80 acres. Her mother was the spiritual leader of the family and an eternal optimist despite the daily struggles of farm life. She was determined that all of her children would be educated, and she taught them reading and math as early as the age of 4. Elders describes her hometown of Shawl as a neighborly place without the racial tensions that people experienced in many other southern towns. Black and white farmers in the area shared equipment and helped each other. Still, there was a difference to being black that could be felt, if not always seen.
I feel that there was an ingrained feeling of inferiority. I felt that, we couldn't do things as well as white people, or if we did, we were ingrained with the feeling that not only did we have to do it as well, we had to do it better in order to be recognized for having done it just as well.
You wrote in your book that you fantasized about someday being a store clerk.
Yes. The reason I fantasized about being a store clerk, to me, I never seen anything better. You can't be what you can't see. And I saw store clerks working in, these buildings out of the sun with fans going. And, they seem to have just had just this wonderful, wonderful job.
In 1944, Dr. Elders would be exposed to a world of new opportunities when she moved with her family to Richmond, California. It was the height of World War II, and there was work to be had in factories and shipyards in the California Bay. Dr. Elders went to a school in a four-story building with white kids, a far cry from the one-room schoolhouse that she was used to. After a placement test, she was enrolled in the eighth grade, jumping ahead two grades. Here, Dr. Elders learned two valuable lessons, that she could compete with the white kids and that she might have a future beyond the cotton fields. She developed an interest in chemistry, and when the family returned to Shaw 2 years later, she enrolled in the Howard County Training School in Tollett. The school was founded after the Civil War by a group of freed slaves and served African-American students in southwest Arkansas. When Dr. Elders graduated, she was 15 years old and valedictorian of a graduating class of nine.
The night of my graduation from high school, that was when there was a man there from Philando Smith, and they offered me a scholarship to Philando Smith College. And I didn't think I would still be able to go. First of all, I didn't think my dad would say I could go because he felt he needed me on the farm, and that is what he said, that as soon as we got big enough to do anything, we left. But my grandmother.
Minnie, was that her grandmother?
Grandma Minnie. She told me, she says, you go on, honey. She said, I got enough young'uns to hold you up. And she told my dad that I had to go and just let me go. So it was because of my Grandma Minnie that I was able to go. And she always said, well, just let your bucket down where you are.
There's a story you write in the book about when you get ready to go to college, you're going to have to catch the bus to go to Little Rock for the first day of classes, and you had to raise some money.
That's
I think
right.
It was $3.
$3.43 or $3.46.
$3.46. And
yes.
You didn't have it.
That's right.
How did you get it?
I'll never forget this. And I've always felt that I had to help my sisters and brothers to get out of the cotton patch, because my sisters and brothers picked cotton in order to raise enough money to give me my bus fare to Little Rock, as I said, which was $3.46. And I remember we'd worked all day, and it was a long, hard day, and we were out there picking cotton, and my younger brother, who's a United Methodist minister now, he was 5 years old or less, looking up at me with those great big eyes, and he wanted to know, not with malice, but he wanted to know, do we have enough yet? And, somehow, I could never forget that. And I promised myself, anytime any of my sisters and brothers wanted to go to school, that I would help them. And I happened to have married a man who was very willing to help everyone that needed help when it was a crisis.
Dr. Elders graduated from Philando Smith in 1952 and was married shortly afterward to Cornelius Reynolds, whom she met at school. The two moved to Milwaukee, where Cornelius had gotten a job with the Internal Revenue Service, while Elders worked as a nurse's aide at the Veterans Administration Hospital. But Elders was still interested in medical school, and she found an opportunity when she enlisted in the Women's Medical Specialist Corps with the Army. While this put an end to her first marriage, it provided the financial means to continue her education. After 3 years in Colorado with the Army, Elders returned to Arkansas to begin medical school. Of the 100 new students entering the University of Arkansas Medical School in 1956, Elders was one of three black students and one of three women. In medical school, Elders thrived, having finally found a compelling challenge to her intellect and ambition. At UAMS, she developed an interest in surgery and pediatrics, but she was torn between the two specialties. As fate would have it, just as she decided to pursue pediatrics and apply for an internship in Minnesota, she met Oliver Elders. Tell me about meeting Dr. or Coach Elders.
That's a really meeting Coach Elders is probably the most important thing that ever happened in my life. But I went, that was the University of Arkansas would send medical students under the supervision of a doctor. They would send medical students over to examine the athletic teams. They still do that. And so I was sent over to examine Horace Mann's basketball team. When I went in, they didn't want to let me in. I mean, the guy said, Coach, there's a woman out here who says she's the doctor and she can't come in. See, he had the guys already stripped down. He came, he said, well, you can't come in here. And I said, well, you want your basketball team examined, don't you? He said, well, I'm the doctor. So he said, he stepped back and his guys were saying, oh, Coach, he was done. We can't have that lady. And so he's all right. He's, I'll be first. And so he got his physical first, and then the guys all lined up to get their physicals. And I tell everybody, I've been examining them ever since.
Four months after they met, Elders and Oliver were married, but Minnesota was still waiting. Elders had been accepted as a pediatric intern, and within a few months, she had to leave Oliver in Arkansas while she continued her education. After a year in Minnesota, Elders returned to Arkansas and finished her pediatric residency at UAMS. In 1963, in her second year of residency, Elders had her first child, Eric, and by the end of the year, she was chief resident. Elders worked 365 days that year, making rounds every day, and was responsible for every pediatric admission. By the time it was over, Elders was ready for private practice, but she was persuaded by her mentor to go into pediatric research, a move that allowed her to balance her work life and family life. As a pediatric endocrinologist, Dr. Elders has written many research papers and has been published in medical journals around the world. What is a pediatric endocrinologist?
A pediatric endocrinologist takes care of diseases of the endocrine systems like diabetes, thyroid disease, growth problems and all, and it's restricted to children. You take care of children with sexual disorders, growth disorders, thyroid, diabetes, anything related to the glands is what you as a pediatric endocrinologist specializes in.
So over the years then, practically every child, every baby with some severe sexual disorder arrived at UAMS.
Oh, absolutely.
And under your care. There was one particular case that you wrote about in your book that I thought was quite poignant and might have had a kind of a transforming effect on your life. You talk about a 13-year-old girl who was referred to you by a physician in the Ozarks, who came down to UAMS. She had all kinds of medical problems.
She had severe hyperthyroidism and was just really very nervous and upset. But when we got ready to discharge her, she started crying.
She's 13 years old.
We're 13 years old. And she didn't want to go home. And, I didn't understand why she didn't want to, all kids always wanted to go home, when it was done. And so she said, every Saturday night, her daddy and her uncles and all and the friends used her. That was her word. And, I didn't really understand what she meant by used her, And then we got Mr. White, the social worker, came, and we began to look into that. But, what transformed me is knowing all of that information, and we didn't have the rules to be able to do much about it then. I discharged her and sent her home. And, I feel that I failed her as a doctor. I may have treated her thyroid disease, but I didn't treat her.
You saw her again later,
yes.
Right? And she was pregnant.
Yep.
This case marked a beginning for Dr. Elders, the start of a lifelong crusade to educate children and the public about the effects of teenage pregnancy. But more than 20 years would pass before Dr. Elders would find herself in a position to make lasting changes. That opportunity came in 1987 when the 41-year-old Governor Bill Clinton asked her to be the director of the Arkansas Department of Health.
When I became the health director, I realized that I was not touching the major problems, that we needed to focus on preventing problems rather than out there trying to treat them, rather than trying to figure out. We were worrying about how to take better care of premature babies, and that was important. I'm not knocking that. But what we needed to do was figure out how could we prevent the births, first of all, of premature babies, and secondly, how could we prevent the birth of children being born to children, which was the greatest cause of poverty. And if we wanted to get Arkansas or the nation out of this poverty and ignorance, we were going to have to address the problem of unplanned pregnancies.
Let me take a moment. I'm going to read a paragraph out of your book. You're writing about going out across the state and seeing all of these clinics, shabby clinics, and all the problems that with these children. And you're right, seeing these places was taking me right back to where I had come from. I could identify with all of it. I wasn't looking at these scenes and saying, oh my goodness gracious, isn't this just terrible? I had lived through it. I didn't have to think, how in God's name do these people survive? I knew how they survived. They survived the same way we had survived, ignorant and without help. And then you say, there but for the grace of God, go I.
And that's exactly how I felt. That was the thing that was always going through my mind. And I remember one of the doctors at the health department, they was talking about, you know, they're bringing me from out of academics into being the director of the health department. And I was relating the stories, you know, some of the stories of the poverty, relating how my brother who had, my dad had taken him to the doctor on the back of a mule. And he said, when he heard me talk about some of these stories, he said, the one thing that we don't have to teach this health director is how to be poor.
So began this crusade. And before long, you had, there were stories in the New York Times, 60 Minutes, the McNeil-Lehrer report, this health director down in Arkansas talking about these issues of sex education, school-based health clinics, teenage pregnancy, and so forth. In a way, nobody else had ever talked about them.
Right.
For more than 25 years, Elders had lived in a different world, but now she was confronting the same kind of poverty that she grew up with. Her answer was school-based health clinics, a place to provide primary preventative health care. But because the clinics might also provide contraceptives, there was resistance.
There ain't no class situation here. I'm saying, like that young man said, leave it out of schools everywhere across this nation, not just Arkansas.
Sex education is pornography.
In an episode of The Arkansas Traveler, produced by AETN in 1988, host Steve Barnes looked at the storm of controversy that surrounded Dr. Elders and her proposals as she attempted to clarify her mission to people from all corners of the state.
This contradicts what we preach. We preach abstinence. We say abstain, don't do it.
You've been preaching abstinence ever since you've been preaching. At least I believe you have. I know my brother preaches that. I've still got a problem in Arkansas. I have 8,000 plus teenagers having babies in Arkansas every year.
Joycelyn Elders doesn't back down. And the man who appointed her says he won't either.
When I appointed her, I said, I want you to deal with the AIDS problem in Arkansas. I want you to deal with a whole range of preventive health problems. I want you to deal with our environmental problems with water quality. And I want you to do something about teenage pregnancy. I want you to do something about it. And you know, unlike a lot of appointees in governmental organizations, she took me seriously. She thought she was supposed to do something.
Do something she did. As director of the state health department, Elders nearly doubled the immunization rate for two-year-olds, oversaw a tenfold increase in the number of early childhood screenings annually, established a women's health agenda, set up rape crisis centers, improved family planning counseling, computerized the health system,
and worked to attract doctors to rural areas, among other things. Then in 1992, shortly after the presidential election, President-elect Bill Clinton invited her to the governor's mansion, where she would be asked to take her agenda to a national stage. What about the job of a Surgeon General? What is the Surgeon General? What does he or she do?
Well, the Surgeon General is really responsible, it's supposed to be the chief health officer for the country. Well, what you are is you work with the President and the Congress on issues related to health, or if there's a major issue related to health going on, where you're kind of responsible to see that that's addressed.
It's not a policymaking job.
No.
But it's a bully pulpit,
it's
right?
It's a bully pulpit.
And you
pulpit.
Used that bully. That was the appeal to it for
that
you,
was,
I guess.
The appeal to me was the bully pulpit, and I felt that I was going to use every inch of that bully pulpit, and I was not going to share any of it with anybody.
So you continued to talk about the same issues you talked about, this time on a much more
a bigger
global
stage.
Bigger stage than you'd ever had before. On the national stage, Elders attracted as much resistance as she did in Arkansas. But her passion for her work transcended protesters and personal attacks. Then at a speech on World AIDS Day, Elders answered a question from a psychiatrist about masturbation and its potential role in preventing the spread of HIV. 10 days later, Leon Panetta, Clinton's chief of staff, asked for her resignation.
And so I told him, I said, well, I'm not going to resign until I talk to the president. He said, well, you can't talk to the president. He's in Florida and we can't. I said, well, I'm sorry. I said, but I'm not going to resign until I talk to the president. So somehow he found the president. And about an hour later, Bill Clinton's on the phone. And Jocelyn, we can't have any more outbursts like that. You know, he was just really in his usual being upset state. And I want your resignation on Panetta's desk by 2:00. And I said, Mr. President, do you know what I said? He told me. I said, no. I said, do you know what I said? He said, yes, I know. And I want your resignation on Panetta's desk. And I just said, I said, well, thank you, Mr. President.
So you did.
And I did.
Do you have any regrets now about taking that job as Surgeon General, given that?
Oh, no. I loved being the Surgeon General. And I would, if I had the opportunity to do that job going back, I would do exactly the same thing. I have no regrets about what I did. I feel I did it right the first time. I have no problems at all.
After you left the Surgeon General's office, you came back directly back to Arkansas in January of 1997. Mm-hmm. And what did you do then? You came back to the medical school.
Well, I came back to the medical school and my old job as a professor of pediatric endocrinology. And I began to see patients and teach medical students as I had done before. I had a lot of speaking engagements. I was on the speaker circuit.
What did you like about being an endocrinologist, that aspect of science?
I could really find answers. That was a way to find answers to what was causing disease. And you could understand it, and you could often treat it. You know, if you're missing a hormone, well, you can replace it. If they've got too much, making too much of a hormone, well, then you could usually suppress it, or you could take out part of the gland or something.
Most will remember Elders for her brief appearance in the national spotlight, but her life has been more than any one moment could capture. Dr. Elders is the eldest of 8 children. She grew up picking cotton during the Great Depression, served in the United States Army, and with passion and determination, went to medical school and became a respected physician and scientist. As an African-American woman, she is a trailblazer and an example to all who followed. She is a wife and a mother. She's a woman who dedicated her life to protecting children and never backed down in the face of controversy.
What is your legacy?
What the legacy that I would like for people to remember me by is that I always fought for our adolescents and our young people, and I supported the things that we needed to do to make life better for them. And I wanted to make sure they were educated. I wanted to make sure they were motivated and that they had hope for the future. And to me, this was about preventing them getting into trouble before they had that opportunity.